Our next speaker is Ford Denison. Ford is a professor in ecology and evolution at the University of Minnesota since 2005. Ford has done research on nitrogen fixation, including stress responses, for the last 40 years. And he is working now on research on rhizobia and legume symbiosis as a model of cooperation with agricultural applications, advising long-term experiments. Ford.
Okay, and my book just came out in paperback, but it's still not as inexpensive as I would have liked. So here's an outline. I'm going to argue that evolutionary processes have improved wild species more than ecosystems. So if we're looking for ideas from nature, we should be looking more at adaptations of species rather than ecosystem organization. But even with individual adaptations, there are trade-offs, which I'll talk about. Fortunately, the evolutionary trade-offs don't always imply severe agronomic trade-offs. In cases where they don't, that's low-hanging fruit opportunities for improvement. So here's a natural ecosystem. This is wild rice growing at the headwaters of the Mississippi, and wild rice grows naturally as a monoculture. So if you're prone to take ideas from nature, you might look at this and say, okay, monoculture, that's what we see in nature, at least in some natural ecosystems, so that's what we should have. But if you look at the actual productivity of wild rice in unmanaged systems like this, it's highly variable, not the sort of thing we would really want in an agricultural system. On the other hand, if we look at the adaptations of the individual plants, we see all sorts of great things, such as adaptation to flooding, where they have these parenchyma air-filled channels that let oxygen diffuse down to the root, and a gas impermeable layer that keeps the oxygen from leaking out before it gets there. So how can we explain this discrepancy between the very sophisticated individual plant adaptations and the relatively poor performance of the ecosystem as a whole? Well, the size and shape of these air channels has been shaped by competition among plants. Plants that had larger or smaller ones competed against each other. Those that did the best produced the most seeds, and their traits were inherited by future generations. Whereas lakes with high and low plant diversity don't compete against each other, and they don't pass their traits on to hundreds of little baby lakes with anything like the accuracy of DNA-based inheritance. And this is a near consensus among evolutionary biologists that natural selection improves individual plant fitness and not plant community performance. There are one or two dissenters, but this seems to be the case, and these are both mathematical papers supporting that concept. But even these individual adaptations are constrained by trade-offs. That's why we don't have, you know, one plant taking over the universe. For example, if we look at flooding related adaptations in rice, one of them involves the plants essentially going dormant when they're submerged, and that conserves resources so that once the water drops, they're able to really take off and do very well. That adaptation doesn't work well in environments where the water keeps getting deeper and deeper over the season. So there's this trade-off from the standpoint of having a plant that's adapted to both kinds of flooding regime. But in an agronomic context, the farmer knows whether he or she is in a short-duration flood environment or a increasing flooding environment and can plant the appropriate genotype. A couple other examples of trade-offs as constraints. Later I'll talk about trade-offs as opportunities. So on the left we have adaptation to acid soils. The vertical axis is yield in acid soils. The horizontal axis, yield of the same genotypes in non-acid soils. You can see the negative relationship. And this is related probably to the metabolic cost of the organic acids that are key to this acid tolerance. On the right, we have the trade-off between protein and oil yield for soybean. Again, a metabolic explanation. Protein and oil are both expensive in terms of photosynthate. And we'll see this graph again at the end of the talk. So now I'm going to talk about just a few examples of wild plants that have really fantastic adaptations to stress and some of the constraints on either domesticating them, transferring their genes, or perhaps copying their strategies, not necessarily using the same genes. On the left is Apios americana. It's a wild North American legume that makes humid edible tubers. And so it's a potential target for domestication, something that might perhaps someday compete with potato and not need nitrogen fertilizer. And here I'm trying to make some field measurements of nitrogen fixation. On the right is casuarina. It's actually a flowering plant, even though it looks like a conifer, but it's a nitrogen-fixing tree. It hosts Frankia bacteria rather than rhizobia. And in this picture, it's growing 6 feet from the Pacific Ocean, so it essentially is fixing nitrogen with its roots in salt water. Now, a big trade-off or challenge that any nitrogen-fixing plant needs is the trade-off between the need for high oxygen flux to the terminal oxidase, because to get the energy to power nitrogen fixation, they need respiration. But they need low oxygen concentration because the enzyme is destroyed, nitrogenase, is destroyed by oxygen. So in legumes, we have this diffusion barrier around the nodule interior, and the oxygen flux through that barrier can be calculated by Fick's law of diffusion, which is analogous to Ohm's law. And over here on the right, we have the vertical axis is the nodule interior oxygen concentration as a function of respiration in arbitrary units. And so up here, everything's fine. The bacteria are cranking away, respiring at a high rate, pulling oxygen concentration, I mean, generating lots of ATP, pulling oxygen concentration low so that oxygen doesn't destroy nitrogenase. But even a very Even a very small decrease in respiration will allow the nodule interior oxygen concentration to rise. And this is the sort of thing you get, you know, soil temperature decreasing a little bit, respiration would tend to go down. Why don't they lose nitrogenase every night as temperature lowers respiration? Well, And of course, they must face much larger decreases in respiration when they get defoliated, when there's a hailstorm knocking off the leaves of a soybean crop or grazing of a pasture legume. So the Frankia-hosting plants have a wide range of adaptations, and the micrograph in the middle is for Dytisca, and it has The symbiotic vesicles here are actually surrounded by a layer of mitochondria that absorb oxygen, and this would be analogous to something that's been suggested for nitrogen-fixing corn, that you could put the nitrogenase gene in the mitochondria, which would be a low-oxygen environment. But how does this deal with fluctuating conditions? Well, Sylvester et al. Raised the oxygen concentration to 40%, and they didn't destroy nitrogenase, so obviously there was some mechanism of protection. But they didn't see an increase in the thickness of the mitochondrial layer, and they attributed this protection to uncoupled respiration, which isn't really something that we would like to have in a high-productivity crop plant. I actually think that the way crop legumes protect nitrogenase now is probably better than at least what I've seen in the Frankia system, but as I say, they have a lot of different ones that are worth looking at. And so we would expect that with a drastic decrease in photosynthesis, nodule interior respiration would be limited, nodule oxygen would go up, and nitrogenase would be fried. But we're able to actually measure nodule oxygen using this little device in the lower left-hand corner, which is similar to what you might have stuck your finger into at a doctor's office. The root nodules contain a hemoglobin, and its spectral properties change when it binds oxygen. So we can measure the hemoglobin oxygenation. And before grazing, it's about 40% oxygenated, a nice healthy level for both respiration and to protect nitrogenase. And then it decreases when we flush the nodule with nitrogen gas. The respiration goes away. When we switch to a high oxygen environment, the hemoglobin saturates in 1, 2, 3, 4 seconds. So much for the famous ability of lake hemoglobin to protect nitrogenase from oxygen that you read about in the latest issue of Science, where they were talking about nitrogen fixing. It'll work for 4 seconds. Now, after defoliation, the hemoglobin, the oxygen level in the nodule is essentially zero. And we know that because when we change from air to nitrogen, there's no change in the signal. And the reason is that the oxygen permeability is really low, and you can see that because it's taking, rather than 4 seconds, it's taking 40 seconds for the oxygen to diffuse into the nodule. So low oxygen protecting nitrogenase, but also the respiration rate is the slope of this line, the decrease of oxygen, and the respiration rate in air is high. It's a relatively, you know, these nodules are cranking along, fixing nitrogen. The respiration rate in air after grazing is the flat line, just essentially zero. So not only have they protected nitrogenase, but they've conserved photosynthate for when they need to turn those nodules back on again and start regrowing. So in this case, it looks like maybe the legumes are doing pretty well. It's not clear whether we can get anything useful from the Frankia system, although being able to grow in salt water could certainly be a useful thing. Now let me turn to water, and the real stars of water use efficiency, of course, are the crassulation acid metabolism plants like agave desert eye, shown at left. And the trade-off, I have the vertical axis is photosynthesis rate, a range of values from a review article, and the horizontal axis water efficiency, again, a range of values, and basically no overlap, you know, much higher water use efficiency in CAM plants, but much lower photosynthesis, even on a per leaf area basis. But notice how thick those leaves are. So on a dry weight basis, it's even worse. And the reason is that these plants basically store CO2 at night. They open their stomata when they get very little transpiration at night, store CO2 as organic acids like malate, building up during the night, and then the next day they decarboxylate and release that CO2, and they can actually fix that CO2 with their stomata closed, so they're not losing any water, and they can do that until they run out of malate, which is constrained by the thickness of those leaves. So they have those thick leaves, and their growth rates tend to be low. Now, pineapple, of course, if you water it, it will switch over to C3 photosynthesis, and then everything's fine. Now, I want to turn to trade-offs as opportunities, which is the main theme of my book. And the easiest to understand, perhaps, is trade-offs between past and present or future conditions. CO2 is increasing, and so we might want a different Rubisco 50 years from now than you know, 200 years ago. But I want to talk about individual plant fitness versus agronomic goals, something which Victor Sodris referred to as well, with an idea from Colin Donald, among others. And if we look at water use efficiency, we have here the vertical axis is yield corrected for the photosynthate cost of the particular biomass. So that's taken from Fritz Penning DeVries. And the horizontal axis is evapotranspiration. So the slope of the line here is water use efficiency. And you can see that while there's a wide range of values, that all the C3 plants are falling on more or less the same line. That is, they have all more or less the same water use efficiency. And the C4s are falling on more or less the same line. So they have this roughly the same water use efficiency. So that's not too encouraging in terms of getting big increases in water use efficiency. And yet, if we look at these data, on the left is dry stale wheat, which was developed by Richard Richards. The vertical axis is the yield benefit, and the horizontal axis is increasingly wet conditions. So 40% yield benefit under very dry conditions, still low absolute yield. decrease in benefit, but apparently never going negative. So there doesn't seem to be a cost under high wet conditions. And then this graph on the right, again, a yield benefit of drought-tolerant things in the vertical axis and increasingly wet conditions in the horizontal axis. And so if you believe the fitted line on this graph, again, there's a benefit under dry conditions and no cost under wet conditions. There's certainly some scatter. So this doesn't look like there's an agronomic trade-off necessarily between wet and dry conditions. But of course, and that would be the important trade-off for a farmer. But from an evolutionary perspective, that's not the only possible trade-off. And so this is simulated data, which Dr. Messina may show. If so, I apologize. But looking at drought tolerance, where the so-called drought-tolerant plants in the top panel actually have more water available, during flowering and so on. And so, of course, they're going to do better. And they have more water because if you look at the lower left panel, they weren't growing quite as fast and using up water early in the season relative to the drought-susceptible variety. So that would be saving water for, a month later. But plants could also save water for a day or several days later. And the mechanism for that is that water use efficiency varies enormously over the course of the day. You know, when it's cool and moist in the morning, the plants can photosynthesize while using very little water. In the afternoon, if they open their stomata, lots of water is going out relative to the amount of CO2 that's going in because things are hot and dry. And so you could get a big increase in water use efficiency of a crop by shutting the stomata in the afternoon, assuming they can tolerate the temperature effects, and saving that water for later. Now, given the millions of years of evolution prior to domestication of our crops, why were these two opportunities missed by natural selection? The answer is obvious, that a plant that saves water for later is going to be next to a plant with a different genotype that doesn't save water for later and uses that water. But in a monoculture field, we can have a whole field of plants that all shut down in the afternoon, and they all then benefit from having that water to use when they can use it more efficiently. Do I have time? Oh, good. Okay, this is not necessarily stress or it's low nitrogen stress, but it's another example of a trade-off based opportunity that I'm kind of exploring at the moment. And the idea goes back to Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, which he attributed to specialization, division of labor, not trying to be a jack of all trades. And so I looked at this and I said, corn is really good at photosynthesis. It's a C4 plant. Why do we expect to get protein from corn? It's not especially good at it can't fix nitrogen. And soybean can fix nitrogen. That's what it's really good at. It's really good at making protein. Why do we expect to get oil from soybean? So what I'm suggesting that we at least explore is the possibility of breeding soybean to be low oil, low starch, high protein, put all the energy that was going into oil into nitrogen fixation, and then for corn, cut the seed protein in half, which we know can be done from long-term experiments. You cut the seed protein in half, you're removing half as much nitrogen from the field, from the farm every year in your harvested grain, so your long-term nitrogen budget is such that you could cut the fertilizer rate potentially in half over the long term and use corn for what it's really good at, which would be photosynthesis, oil, or starch, not for protein. The graph on the left, the vertical line is the just a simple fitted curve. The dashed line is the theoretical curve based on Penning DeBries's energy cost of protein and oil, but basically talking about moving legumes towards the towards the left and sacrificing oil to get protein, moving non-legume C4 crops towards the right, sacrificing protein to get higher yield and lower fertilizer needs. And it's probably just breeding for low oil isn't going to automatically increase nitrogen fixation. We need to actually also look at the efficiency of nitrogen fixation. How much respiration does it cost for a given amount of nitrogen fixation? And that's what this apparatus measures, but that would be another seminar. So to conclude, the organization of natural ecosystems is unlikely to be optimal, but if we want to understand the adaptations of wild plants, and while I've kind of, dissed a couple of them, I do think there's a lot of potential there. If you want to understand those adaptations, probably those natural ecosystems are a good place to study. I mean, you wouldn't understand the function of this trichome that releases this chemical if you didn't know that there are aphids there that are scared away by aphid alarm pheromone produced by wild potatoes, for example. Trade-offs are a significant constraint on evolution and still an ongoing constraint on plant breeding, but there are cases where the trade-offs that constrain past evolution don't need to constrain us in agriculture, and that's the low-hanging fruit for crop improvement. Thanks for your attention. Yes.
From that perspective, how do we learn from the natural selection?
I think the trick is that if we're looking at wild species for all of these sophisticated adaptations, but we then have to ask the question, is this a trait that was only beneficial to individuals, or is it something that might have a community benefit? So, for example, there's been a lot of talk about proteoid roots, these roots that release chemicals that solubilize phosphorus in the soil. And an interesting property of those roots is that they only last for about a week and then shut down. Now, part of that is that they're mining the soil, but the other part is that's how long it takes the neighbor's root to get there. So that may well be a trait that allows an individual plant to grab the phosphorus from a decaying root before its neighbor does, but doesn't necessarily increase the overall productivity, at least once you've mined the phosphorus that's in the soil. I think we'd find similar examples. I mean, Colin Donald's paper is great. If you haven't read it in the last 5 years, it's worth reading it again. Well, of course, one I don't know, but the levels of materials in the seed are shaped by what it takes to have a really vigorous seedling, not by what we need in, feeding cattle or whatever. So one possibility that was suggested to me when I visited Erie was we have all this phytate in seeds, which is not digestible by humans or animals, but it's there for the seedling. Cut that phytate way down, and then coat the seeds, the 1% of seeds that get planted, coat them with phosphorus. And I would expect to do a similar thing. If we bring the nitrogen or, in particular, the protein level of seeds down really low, you might need to coat that seed with some kind of a nitrogen source, but you would only do that to the 1% of seeds that were planted.
We're not dealing with human culture, and in terms of sacrificing the human
Well, the main thing that worries me about that is that the benefits of those mixtures are almost always studied as a one-year study. And so there's a model by, I believe it was a Dr. Yang that I cite in my book, where I say, okay, you know, you could do this mixture, or you could do a rotation of the same genotypes or the same species. And what are the relative benefits of, I mean, so you've got this mixture, disease spreads slowly through the field, but it keeps going forever. You know, if your whole landscape is covered with the mixture. Whereas if you're doing rotation, you've got a patch of one species next to a patch of another species. Your disease spreads fast through the monoculture, but then it's got this huge gap. Plus you have the carryover issues from rotation. So that's what I really want to see is, you know, a six-year comparison of intercropping with rotation, see how those do. And the modeling suggests that the rotation might actually do better. Now, if you have an infinite number of genotypes that are all agronomically fine, then sure, mix them. But if we have a limited amount of diversity available, you really have to think about deploying it in time and not just in space.